Welcome to Scottish Ballet's Half Hour Call.
It's a blood stage. Why not come in?
Escape the backstage commotion and find a quiet moment in the dressing room of Scottish Ballet. In each episode, we'll be joined by special guests for a frank and unfiltered conversation about the world we live in and where a ballet company fits into it. In this episode, we explore social prescribing as Scottish Ballet's senior dance health manager, Lisa Sinclair, is joined by consultant in emergency medicine, Dr. Dave Caesar, and Roseanne Logan from Alliance Scotland.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is your half-hour call to the start of this evening's performance. You have 30 minutes. Your half-hour call, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Hi, both, and welcome to our half-hour call. It's great to have you both here.
Hi, Lisa. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Lisa. Thanks for having me.
Dave, good to have you with us. We know each other quite well already through our work, but can you give our listeners a background of what you do?
Thanks, Lisa. Morning. So I am a doctor in emergency medicine. So that means that I spend a lot of time in A&E departments and our A&E department here at the Royal Infirmary in Edinburgh. And recently, between 2016 and 2023, this year, I was working for the government advising around a sort of range of things, but that drew me into how can we try and raise our ability to keep people well. So prevent them coming to places like A&E, but also to the doctor and various other things. So, and how can we establish the necessary leadership and system changes to enable that to be more likely to happen? And that connected me with you, Lisa, and a few other wonderful people at Scottish Ballet. And I've been involved with Scottish Ballet ever since.
We're achieving some really wonderful things through those connections too. So it's been great. It's been a great journey with you. Thank you so much, Dave. And Roseanne, can you tell us a bit about your work with the Health and Social Care Alliance Scotland? What is social prescribing and who is it for?
It's an approach that it connects people with local activities, local services to look at issues that they can then be supported to deal with, whether that be practical, social or emotional needs that are affecting their health and wellbeing. The King's Fund reported that those individuals that could benefit from social prescribing include people with mild to long-term mental health problems, people with complex needs, people with multiple long-term conditions, people who frequently attend either primary or secondary care. For me, social prescribing is much deeper than that. It's for anyone, any age, anyone that could benefit from linking in and making connections that would benefit them and support them to live their best life. And that's what social prescribing should be about. It should be about supporting individuals to link with communities, to link with assets, to link with something that is going to benefit them and benefit them to live their life as well as they want to live their life.
Thank you so much. It's really, really fascinating to hear all of that. Dave, can you please describe, and you are a clinician, can you describe the difference between a medical approach and a non-medical approach?
Yeah, so when I was training in the 90s, we went to learn anatomy, the way that the body's put together, physiology, the way that the body works, the body systems function, and then pathology. So what goes wrong with all of that? And then what the medicine is that you need to prevent that thing happening, or the surgery that needs to make that better or cut that tumor out, or the, you know, it's come on a bit more now, but the other sort of therapies that are out there. And this was, you know, this has been the sort of the dominant model of how we know things work and prescribe medicines, surgeries. It's always been very focused on disease. So we are essentially a profession that deals with disease rather than really gets into the promotion of wellness and well-being. And of course, medicine as a modern practice is really quite new in the evolution of mankind, if you like. So before medicine exists, there was, of course, a lot of wisdom around what kept us well. And we know that when we now reconnect with people either through a social prescribing route or just we generally intuit it. So most people know that going for a walk will make them feel a bit better. Most people know that listening to music or doing something else that's soulful makes them feel better, makes them feel well. And we've known this forever. We've known that connecting with nature makes us feel well. We know that connecting with others makes us feel well. We've now come to learn, actually, in an overlap of a clinical and non-clinical approach or a medical and non-medical approach, that actually there is great value in some of these less traditional medical approaches. So medicines, by definition, will all have side effects. Surgeries will all have side effects. All the treatments that doctors give have side effects. So they need to be able to give benefit to counter those side effects. Quite a lot of the non-medical treatments have no side effects. In fact, have positive additional effects to others and to the people that might be partaking in them, and are far deeper rooted than that very specific disease response outcome, if you like, sort of linear relationship. And I mentioned about, you know, this is kind of about soulful prescribing often. This is about something more than just a disease and a medical response to it. This is about how we be well in our entirety, as well as actually make material gains. And as you've seen, Lisa, in some of the programs in Scottish Ballet, make material gains in things that otherwise medicines can't sometimes achieve. And we're starting to learn more about that from a medical perspective, around how the brain works, around how it develops, around how neural pathways can be reignited by non-medical means. So dance and music and movement can actually reignite things that medicines can't unlock, especially, you know, we've seen that in the Parkinson's work. And that, you know, that's where the real excitement around some of these social prescribing advances can really take us forward, which is having that sort of understanding that this is not, you know, witchcraftery. This is actually providing material benefit in a medical and non-medical sense to people that otherwise wouldn't be able to achieve that benefit. And they feel brilliant doing it, which is the other thing. So there are some medicines that make you feel brilliant, but not all of them do. And they nearly all have side effects. So I think there is more of an overlap now than we used to maybe exist, but certainly that's taking a real change in mindset from the medical profession and others that sit around it, you know, the sort of healthcare system as a whole. And we need to understand that more and embrace that more.
And really exciting and encouraging to hear that there is more of an overlap, and that awareness and that bridge between medical and non-medical is perhaps starting to form. I wonder as well, could you tell us a little bit about realistic medicine? You were talking about, you know, essentially addressing the whole being and looking at perhaps things that maybe have less side effects on people and less negative impacts. Could you tell us a little bit about realistic medicine and how this might link in?
Realistic medicine is really just sort of trying to understand, well, how are we adding value to these patients by giving medicines? And should we? Should we be prescribing that thing? Should we be doing that thing? Is there something else that could be adding more value, less cost to the patient? What I mean by that is less cost in terms of side effects, less cost in terms of interventions, less cost in terms of time spent in hospital, less cost in terms of time off work, all these things. Is there something else that could actually be better value, possibly cheaper to deliver, and also make them feel better as a person, that we should be exploring here? So that's where the link to social prescribing is, which is that many of the interventions in the social prescribing space, which is often falls into what might be called the preventative kind of work. So regular exercise every day for the entirety of middle life, for example, will reduce your chances of getting cancer, will reduce your chances of getting dementia, will reduce your chances of being diabetic, and will make you feel great, and also live longer, and also be more active, and possibly be more likely to be at work. It costs nothing, really. And it's really difficult to show the, if you like, the cost-benefit ratio to that, because you don't see the thing that costs at the end of it because you're preventing it. But by and large, there is nearly always a multiplication factor. So every pound spent on a social prescribing intervention, for example, usually reveals somewhere between £3 and £6 or £7 worth of savings. That's amazing. You know, it's brilliant health economics, but it's really hard to get into that social consciousness, if you like. And partly it's because it takes a different approach. It takes us a more coaching approach. It takes involvement from the person that's involved in it often, and it takes motivation, and it's not like, oh, here's a tablet, take it every morning, see what happens. It might make you feel worse, but someone somewhere might get a benefit if we give it to enough people, kind of thing. And that's the sort of paradigm that we're trying to shift here. But really, so medicine is all about how do we get best value? And there will be many people that will get value from medicines, no doubt about it. I mean, we've shown that. And there may be some that aren't. And it's about how we sort of are more tailored in how we use our healthcare resources.
Oh my goodness, the return on investment figures are quite staggering to hear, actually, that there's some fantastic statistics around that as well. Really, really interesting to hear that. So that links in nicely with the next question from me is, why is Scottish Bally discussing this topic of social prescribing? In terms of our journey, we are a National Centre for Dance Health, and we launched that officially in January. And really what that means is, well, rather than it being a physical building or space, it's really about Scottish Bally's commitment as an organisation to our SB Health programme. And we've developed that programme for around 10 years now, which includes young people's mental health and wellbeing projects, wellbeing resources for health staff, more recently long COVID support as well, specialist training, research, and our three neurological programmes, which are Dance for Parkinson's Scotland, and that's actually part of a national infrastructure, national network of Parkinson's classes that run all over Scotland. It also includes our dementia-friendly programme, Time to Dance, and our Dance for MS programme, Elevate. And so over the last 10 years, we've been able to really learn from people with lived experience, learn from specialists, bring artists into the space, and really develop experiences and programmes that help people to feel their best. So thank you for listening to that. That was a bit of a whistle-stop tour there of the last 10 years of work as an organisation in this area. But I think now we'd like to hear a little bit more from one of our dancers, and we're going to bring in Sheena, who is going to tell us a little bit more about how she got involved in SB Health.
My name is Sheena, and I came to the classes about 2 years ago, and when it was on Zoom, because I was diagnosed just as lockdown came. Didn't have anybody to talk to about what was going on and just how things would progress. But my podiatrist, she said, oh, I've got another client who does ballet lessons. She's got Parkinson's. And I said, oh, tell me more. Because I'd read up. I'm a scientist, so I wanted to know what the research was and what I should be doing. And the research said very clearly that you should do exercise, and if you could get something that was specific for Parkinson's, they would be giving you the right kind of stretches. But when I got to see the class on Zoom, I realised it was just fun. Every sort of formal ballet class suddenly had a story and had live music, and I didn't realise how much I was missing these things. When I talked to my consultant when he was doing my recent checkup, he said, you're doing very well. Doing very well means things are going slowly. It's not that I'm getting better. And you have to be kind of realistic about things. He reckoned that the ballet class, and I also do a singing class. So here I am, nearly 80, and doing ballet classes and choir. But it's to make sure my face doesn't get stiff, and I'm just loving it.
So we just heard from Sheena there, and so lovely to hear from her, and how beneficial song, singing and dancing have been to her and her journey with Parkinson's. Scottish Bally's journey gives just one example of social prescribing in practice, but we know that there is so much fantastic work happening all across Scotland within a range of communities. Roseanne, I'd like to bring you in now, if that's okay. What other kinds of social prescribing activities are there, and where might you prescribe those?
Yeah, Lisa, there's so many different activities and examples, you know, of social prescribing, from walking groups. We really advocate walking groups because a lot of individuals we'll work with is maybe around about looking at forms of physical activity. And for some people, going to a gym or going to, a particular class may be too big a step for them. So, involving people in local walking groups is really important. There's a variety of different activities that RSPB are involved with around social prescribing. And that's about mindfulness. It's about noticing what's around you. It's about looking at nature. Isn't about going out into the wilds of Scotland. It's about walking in your local park. It's about even walking in your streets and listening and hearing birds. And that's all part of social prescribing. But we've also got gardening groups. As Sheena spoke there, there's singing for health groups. And we haven't yet not found something for any individual. And we have worked with thousands of individuals, whether that be a boxing class, weightlifting, gardening. And for what one of the big issues that we find is around social isolation and loneliness. And so being involved in some of these activities, again, as Dave was saying, it's great for people's mental health, great for people's overall well-being. It brings a bit of fun. It brings people together, and it's those connections. It's about making those connections, you know. So you've got physical activity around social prescribing. We've got dance. We've also got the arts. You know, we've linked in with the museums and had men at museums. So bringing older gentlemen, mm-hmm. having a walk around a museum where they're then also having that chat. We've been able to work with other groups around jewellery making, you know, and that's just a small number, you know, that I've touched on already. But you've got men's sheds, you've got bereavement cafes. These are all social prescribing because these are linking people in to activities. Whereas maybe before, I mean, Dave was speaking about that medical model. That's all we had to rely on before. We didn't have these other activities, which we now do have, you know. So it's great that rather than just be prescribing an antidepressant for someone, if they are grieving, that's a process. That's a journey for someone. Maybe linking in with a bereavement cafe and going along. Maybe that's what that person needs. They may, that peer support, talking to other people in the same situation that they've been in.
It's really inspiring, I have to say. And it sounds like there's nothing is off limits, actually. There's something for everybody there. And that's really wonderful. It sounds like a real person-centered approach, really thinking about that individual and genuinely what their needs are. What is it that they love to do? And how can that help them? Dave, we heard from Sheena what the benefits were to her from taking part in classes here at SB. How do you feel an individual might benefit from something like this?
Just hearing that firsthand from someone like Sheena is just awe-inspiring. And again, goes a long way to sort of describe, if you like, that benefit, which is that, you know, as she was saying, it's not about curing people. It's about reducing the rate of a disease progression sometimes. You know, sometimes it is about getting people back into a way of living, a way of being that enables them to function to the best of their capability, as Roseanne was describing. You know, some of these things will enable people to have a level of independence that they otherwise wouldn't have. So we know that we have issues with care provision, and that, you know, some of what Roseanne is describing, these formal things of which are popping up all over the place, are in many ways trying to reestablish what communities used to do in some shape or form and reconnect people to support that, because of modern life, is now just not there. And we lean heavily on medicine, and we leave as a sort of broad thing, and we lean heavily on care, so care provision. And if we can reduce that leaning on for both of these things, I mean, we meet people in hospital all the time who are desperate to be at home, desperate to be independent, desperate to be able to look after themselves, desperate to not have to lean on other things, and to sort of feel happier and more well in themselves. And if these things can help us do that for people, then that must be a good thing. That must be a good thing. And so these are some of the mechanisms by which these things can happen. But what we do know is the further upstream you can make that, absolutely, the more effective it is. So I was talking about the sort of return on investment. The best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago, and the next best time is now, kind of thing. So, you know, yes, we'd all want to do it then, but actually, if we can encourage through these services, so sort of formal, semi-formal route through social prescribing, or through that sense that this is generally the thing that we should all be doing more of, then we will have a healthier population. We will have a happier population, and we will have a population that is more able to do the things that it wants to do, rather than rely on, if you like, the big machineries of state, which actually possibly don't help them be the people that they want to be anyway. So that would be my sense of it.
Really interesting to think about this sense of almost shifting the power dynamic back onto the individual, you know, by really empowering people to live fuller, independent lives for longer. How then does that benefit the health sector and help to address wider health priorities?
I mean, so as we are at the moment in Scotland, post-pandemic, we not only have, we have always had, but we not only have a huge burden of chronic disease. So it is very rare for people to be over 65 years of age and not have at least one chronic disease. Most people have at least one, and many have multiple chronic diseases. So things like diabetes, breathing problems, COPD, heart disease, cancers, neurological conditions, as we've described, but also dementias and things like that. These things are very prevalent in the Scottish population. There are lots of reasons for that. It's complex, but they're there. But we also have, especially post-pandemic, we have a whole sort of generation of young people as well that have been really adversely affected by the impact on their ability to effectively progress their socialization, to have those peer connections. And that's showing up in a lot of different ways, but especially around, you know, the mental health burden of that younger generation. And we still don't know what the impact will be of that. But we know that those that come through adversity, especially at a younger age, in a formative time of their lives, we know that that has long-lasting impact. We know that from trauma-informed practice and the research around trauma in younger age, that there's likely to be a health burden on these that these people will suffer. And the more we can do to mitigate some of that, counteract some of that earlier into that journey for them, then absolutely the better we will be as a country going forward.
Thank you so much, Dave. And you know, it's just incredible to hear of the impact that so many of these things are having across multiple generations. And hopefully through these programs, Roseanne, as you were saying before, you know, there really is something for everyone, and hopefully there is something that can support people throughout their life's journey and to really live their best and fullest life. So we're now going to pass over to Heather and Denise, who are going to talk a little bit about how they also got into SB Health.
Sure. So my name's Heather Eland. I live in East Kilbride, and I've always been involved in some form of dance, theatre, right up until I got diagnosed in 2017 with MS. And at that point there, coming to terms with the disease, first of all, and I kind of thought that my dancing was going to be over. But I've got a friend who comes to one of the adult classes here with Scottish Ballet, and when the pilot was getting started up, she obviously knew that I had MS and knew that I loved to dance, and so she said, why don't you come along? So I thought, well, do you know what? I've got nothing to lose. Come along. If I don't like it, I don't have to come back. It's not like going to the doctor's where it's kind of definite. And so that's how I got involved, and I've been loving it ever since.
I'm Denise Noon, and I got my diagnosis a bit longer ago. I got mine in 2013. But I, unlike Heather, I've not got any dance background at all. I've not danced at all, not been particularly interested in dancing. And it was just during one of my routine nurse's appointments, I think, or a physiotherapy appointment, that somebody told me about their dance class. It's my exercise for the day, among you know, the sort of mental benefits, it's like a physical benefit. And you do feel like you move, don't you?
But there is a sense of peace, I think, that comes from being peace and euphoria, which is a strange combination to have. But that's something that I have been trying for so long through different, because I really just want them to almost advertise this class. And I keep saying that, you know, things like your MS nurse or, you know, your consultant or whatever it is, for this to actually be part of the NHS, so that when you get diagnosed, that you're able, that they're able to say, yes, there's lots of these different clinical options that's there for you. There's all this medication that's there. You can go along to do all these different courses, like the fatigue course I mentioned. But there's actually something that's here that can help you with your creativity. And it's with people who will understand what it is that you're going through and can actually help you with whatever questions that you have. Because there's so many questions. I don't know if you found this, but I was really overwhelmed for a period when I first was told, oh, there's all these different medications, and you don't know what your life's going to look like when you get MS. And so to come along to something like this, it's really supportive underneath all of that.
Basically, it's not a chemical, but it is a medicine. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that. I think that it's made me feel a lot better than any kind of chemical interventions and stuff like that.
Roseanne, it would be great to bring you in here. We've just heard from Heather and Denise about how they found their way into our classes at Glasgow, our Glasgow base. We'd mentioned before, and we talked about the varying mechanisms to get people into socially prescribed activities like this. Can you tell us how it works in practice?
What happens is that individuals will be referred by maybe one of the practice team to their links worker. And as I had previously mentioned, you know, it's about having a good conversation with the individual. So it's sitting down with them and asking what matters to them, looking at what it is that they want to address. And through that, looking then to see what activities there are within the community. It may be as simple as meeting with someone who has maybe been bereaved after 40 years of marriage and asking them, you know, talking about, well, what did you do together? Is that something you would like to do again? And it may be looking for a ballroom dancing afternoon tea class for someone. But it's maybe not just as simple as that, because that might be too big a step for some people. So where the links workers are really invaluable is that they will support someone along to an activity or a class. If for someone they maybe felt that live in Drumchapel and they think, oh, Scottish ballet, I've never been to ballet, I don't know anything about that. The links worker saying to them, well, I know the people that run the group, I know the people because I've met them, I've built that connection. I can even come along with you to that very first meeting so that it's not as daunting.
Thank you, Roseanne. It sounds like the community links workers are a really key part of that process, a real connector and helping people to build and find that trust as well. Can you tell us about some of the challenges on the ground?
I think the biggest challenge at the moment is around funding, and especially for a lot of third sector organisations. And that's just the nature of where we're at this moment in time. And a lot of organisations are still trying to run on limited funding, or maybe having to change some of the criteria. So keeping up to date with what's happening, that can be a big issue and linking in with that. But knowing what's available, I think, can overcome some of the challenges that are there. And one of the other things as well is that for some people, that prospect of travelling out with their area. So some of the challenges can be if we've not got activities that are maybe more localised. And that's something individuals in neighbourhoods and not want to move out, that kind of territorial aspect is something that's been around for a long, long time. And we think it's really important to try and bring activities into neighbourhoods.
Thank you so much. And, you know, I'm sure that many, many organisations working across Scotland in this area would very much feel that and echo what you're saying with that too, Roseanne. You had mentioned something about trust and perhaps the perceptions of something might not be for me. For example, you know, ballet dance, I've never danced before, that might not be for me. Dave, can we bring you in here, please? What do you think some of the challenges might be or difficulties in implementing social prescribing more at a policy level?
So as we were talking about earlier, there is this dominance of the sort of biomedical model of health, if you like. But I think social prescribing is one really important element of a more holistic understanding of what contributes to health and well-being. And, you know, we spend upwards of £15-16 billion a year in Scotland alone on healthcare. That's a lot of money. Within that, of course, then there is a lot of, I'm going to use a dirty word now, there's a lot of power and influence wrapped up in that, which is that suggesting that that money could be spent in a different way on things that might prevent the need for some of that or slow down the acceleration of the increased need for that is really difficult. And there is space for everything. I think that's the thing. So there's an opportunity there if we were to grasp the nettle. But there's a lot of, you know, inherent, as I said, you know, I wasn't trained in medicine to think about these things at all. It wasn't on the radar. It was witchcraftery, weird alternative stuff. But actually, it isn't. And yes, of course, it needs to be rigorously assessed. And yes, of course, it needs to be robustly evidence based. And because anecdote and storytelling is really important and very powerful, and not enough on its own to convince funders, decision makers that this is something that needs sustainable, long term commitment and investment in the right circumstances, with the right evidence base, in the right direction. And again, that realistic medicine thing, you know, it needs to be the same for all of it, which is that it needs to add value. It can't just be, you know, a nicety or this is about actually maintaining people's wellness. How do we do that? How do we encourage it? Not everyone needs a service. Not everyone needs a medicine. Not everyone needs anything. They just need some information, or they just need to know how best to do it, or to make sure that they're not making anything any worse. But that's the approach. It needs to be part of the mix of a health and well-being economy that places people's wellness at the center of our country's future, because that is what our country's future depends on.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your Act One Beginners Call. Ladies and gentlemen of the orchestra, would you please make your way to the pit? Your Act One Beginners Call, please, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Now this brings us to our Beginners Call, where we give you the chance to reflect on where the conversation should go next. So I'd like to ask, what needs to happen for social prescribing to be available to all?
So probably three very simple things. One is a much broader awareness of their availability. And that's through all sorts of things, the things that Roseanne's mentioning. So a very sort of, if you like, local unit-based level. So GP practice to have that sort of citizen's advice or post office or whatever it is, sort of to have that sense of what's out there. So that network of awareness and the ability to sort of just navigate through that. It can be quite overwhelming, bewildering sometimes to know what's right or where to start. Second thing is that it needs to, as we were talking about, have parity. So it needs to have that sort of the rigor around why it's there and what it's for, but essentially then to give confidence. So it's one thing to have awareness, but also to have confidence that this is adding value, and that commitment to that confidence to be able to provide that. Both of those things are reliant on the third thing, which is probably the most important thing, which is around sustainable funding for some of this stuff, which is that it's really hard for some of these really kind of high impact, but often very local, high quality services and support mechanisms. They are in an annual battle for funding. So a different approach, but that requires that sort of commitment, that long-term commitment, and that requires the evidence to support the intervention and the awareness of it and the understanding that this is transformative for many people. What intervention do we have in healthcare that provides peace and euphoria?
Everybody wants to feel peace and euphoria. It's part of what makes us human, all of these experiences. Roseanne, what do you feel? Is there anything that you feel that needs to happen for social prescribing to become more accessible to all?
I'm really fortunate that I sit on the steering group of the Scottish Social Prescribing Network, which is still in its infancy. You know, we're just over 2 years old. We're like-minded individuals that have day jobs, but have been trying to push forward this network. But we've still got a bit of a journey to go. We need for the SSPN to continue to become more established. As, you know, as Dave was saying there, we need to be raising awareness of social prescribing. And the social prescribing movement is taking off. We've been on the go for over 9 years. We were leaps ahead of our other UK counterparts that are now leaps ahead of us because there's been greater buy-in from NHS England for the English portfolio. The Welsh Nation are just about to produce some findings from work they've been doing around social prescribing. So we still have a bit of a learning journey to go, but I feel a lot more positive today than maybe if you'd asked me a couple of weeks ago, because I now can see where Scottish Government, what they're wanting to do, how they're wanting to be involved. And that's really positive for us. And that's brilliant. You know, it's great for the people of Scotland that will ensure that if someone needs to access a social prescriber, if someone needs to access a service, that's available there for them, no matter where they live, no matter what part of the country, it's there. And I'll always go on about funding. I've worked in the third sector since I left the NHS when I was a nurse. So I'm always banding on about funding, but that's part of being in the third sector. You know, we're always seen as the poor relatives, but we're doing the best work. I'll just finish with that, Dave.
Thank you so much. And thank you. That's a really lovely, a lovely note to finish on as well. Well done. Well done to you and your colleagues for making such great progress with the network as well. That's fantastic news. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks, Lisa. Have a good day.
Thanks, Lisa. Pleasure to be part of it.